if you had to guess why he walked out, it's
leverage. He only wants the boy for leverage because when his boss...
No, why did Ethan walk? Why would you say...
Ethan's confused. He doesn't know where he is. It's a new place.
He's confused.
Nestled within Davis County, Utah, Layton stands as a vibrant city, intimately connected to the bustling heart of Salt Lake City. This commuter's haven, with its approximately 80,000 residents, has carved its place on the map. However, in spring of 2010, citizens of Layton awoke to find police officers scouring throughout the neighborhoods. They were searching for a little boy who had inexplicably vanished in the middle of the night. Ethan Stacey was born on the 22nd of September 2005 to Stephanie and Joe Stacey. He was born at the Fort Stewart Army Base in Georgia, and shortly thereafter, the Stacey family relocated from Georgia to Florida, where they established their new home. Ethan was an ordinary young boy, brimming with a zest for life and a deep love for the Transformers. His father, Joe, fondly recollected, "He was the best little boy that you'd ever meet. He really was. He was a very lovable child, and that's all he wanted, was to love on people all the time." His grandmother, Freda Stacey, characterized him as an affectionate child with boundless determination, a young soul capable of achieving whatever he set his mind to. In addition to his warm-hearted nature, Ethan possessed a talent for bringing joy to others through his amusing facial expressions. Amber Llewellyn, a close friend of the family, remembered, "Ethan was very loving. He loved hugs and he was a funny kid. He would make you laugh just by being himself. He was always happy and he loved his daddy." Despite his tender age of just 4, Ethan was already displaying signs of remarkable intelligence. Joe said that he could teach Ethan something and the young boy would grasp it almost instantly. Joe recalled, "He's just a very intelligent boy." The union between Stephanie and Joe eventually crumbled, culminating in their separation towards the end of 2009. Joe returned to Richlands, Virginia, his hometown, while Stephanie relocated to Layton in Utah. Following their divorce, custody of Ethan was granted to his father. According to the divorce documents, Joe expressed his concern. "The mother has always abandoned the child, and I'm afraid the mother will come and take him, and I'll never see him again." On the 28th of April 2010, the divorce was finalized, and 4-year-old Ethan was sent to live with Stephanie at her Layton Meadow apartment in Layton, Utah, albeit only for the summer. Ethan had developed a deep attachment to living with his father in Richlands, Virginia. However, the contentious custody battle led to a court order requiring Ethan to spend the summer with his mother in Layton, and the remainder of his time with his father in Richlands. For Joe, who had dedicated his life to his son, the decision for Ethan to spend the summer with Stephanie was heartbreaking. He expressed, "I just wanted him to grow up where his daddy grew up, in a small town in the mountains, where it was safe." Joe had worked tirelessly to provide a life of pride and happiness for his son, with their cherished moments often spent at the nearby park, and engaging in PlayStation 3 adventures with Spider-Man. Ethan undeniably held a special bond with his father, as his grandmother Freda attested. Ethan did not want to even talk to his mother on the phone. She'd call and he'd say, "I don't want to talk to her." Meanwhile, over in Layton, Stephanie had a new boyfriend named Nathan Sloop. Even before Ethan's move to Layton, Nathan had been sending Joe threatening text messages. Joe recalled the ordeal, stating, "I've been threatened over the past 6 months by him." The Stacey family believed that Stephanie's motives extended beyond wanting custody of Ethan. They suspected she only wanted Ethan with her for the summer to hurt Joe. Freda noted, "It was like Ethan was just a pawn." Since there was a court order for Ethan to spend the summer with Stephanie, there was nothing that could be done. It was a quiet night for Leighton police on the 10th of May, 2010. Shortly after midnight, a call came in to police from Stephanie, who reported that Ethan had disappeared from their Leighton Meadow apartment. According to Stephanie, she had tucked Ethan into bed at around 11 p.m. that night. Approximately an hour later, she went to check on him, only to discover an empty bed. Frantically, she scoured the entire apartment, but Ethan had seemingly vanished. Stephanie informed detectives that this wasn't the first time that Ethan had wandered off during the night. Upon the arrival of detectives at their home, Stephanie disclosed that despite Ethan's brief 10-day stay, he had already strayed from home 5 times.
When he's walked out the 5 times, he hasn't made it out of the courtyard, that's correct. What have you guys talked to him about? I mean, does he...
Well, I've tried to sit him down and explain to him that he can't do that, that if he wakes up, he needs to... Because we leave our bedroom door open.
Mm-hmm.
So if he needs anything, he can come in and get me or get Nathan.
When pressed for the reason behind Ethan's disappearances, Stephanie immediately pointed fingers at Joe.
If you had to guess why he walked out, it's
leverage. He only wants the boy for leverage because when his foster...
Why did Ethan walk? Why would you say
Ethan? Ethan's confused. He doesn't know where he is. It's a new place.
He's confused?
His daddy told him that I was dead, that I wasn't ever coming back. And then now that he's here with me, he's confused.
So his father's kind of mentally abusive?
I have no idea.
I just had to ask that question, okay, thanks.
Detectives then inquired about the activities Stephanie had engaged in with Ethan since his arrival.
What kind of things have you done with Ethan since he got here? Is there anything around?
I don't ever speak to him. I've never spoke to him.
No, I'm talking, where have you taken him? We're trying to figure out where he might have gone.
I've taken him to the park. I've taken him to the store, to Walmart. He's had to work with me. I work at the Blockbuster in Roy until he closes next week. But I do everything for that boy. I love him that much. Whereas most women would have been like, no, I want this, this, and this. All I wanted was him. I just wanted my baby.
Time was of the essence in this urgent situation. It's widely recognized that the initial 48 hours of a disappearance, especially involving a child, are critical. As time passes, the chances of locating the missing individual alive dwindle. Despite a thorough search of the immediate vicinity, Ethan remained elusive. Detectives commenced door-to-door searches as a precautionary measure to check if Ethan had somehow entered somebody else's home. Ethan was described as standing at approximately 4 feet 4 inches tall, and weighing around 50 pounds. He had blonde hair and striking blue eyes. When last seen by his mother, he was dressed in Spider-Man pajamas. Over 40 officers were mobilized to search for Ethan, with the invaluable assistance of canine sniffer dogs, scouring a 1 mile radius around the apartment. The search continued relentlessly throughout the night, aided by flashlights, and carried on into dawn. One significant aspect of the investigation involved questioning a dozen registered sex offenders residing in the vicinity. There loomed a pervasive fear that Ethan might have wandered off at night, potentially encountering a child predator. While the search was underway, Stephanie and Nathan were separated and questioned. It became increasingly evident that their narratives were diverging and inconsistent with one another. In a moment of emotional breakdown, Stephanie confessed that Nathan had become consumed by jealousy towards Ethan.
Well, then I guess Nathan's beginning to get frustrated with him because I wanted to spend time with him. I don't know what
okay,
Nathan's
yeah, slow down with. A little bit for us, okay? So Nathan was getting frustrated with Ethan because of all the time Ethan was wanting to spend with you? Is that what you're saying?
Because he was spending time with him because he was just blabbing his mouth, telling everybody what his daddy did. I don't know why he was being that way. I don't know why.
Was he jealous of Ethan at the time?
He's never acted that way before. Never.
What did he say to make you feel he was, like, jealous of Ethan?
He would say that Ethan was being disrespectful, and that I couldn't bring myself to spank my kid. I've never spanked my kid. I've never had to spank my kid.
Okay.
And it was okay the first couple of times. Swatty was out there. Okay, I can deal with that. You know, maybe he was wrong for yelling at me and or saying something about me, the baby. You know, something. And Tuesday night, he took him in there. And I freaked out because I opened the door and said, enough is enough.
Okay, so let's go to Tuesday night.
She then shifted her focus to the night preceding Ethan's disappearance, recounting how he had awoken in the middle of the night to play PlayStation.
Ethan had gotten up in the middle of the night and was playing the PlayStation in the middle of the night.
Playing what?
PlayStation in the middle of the night. I never can't do that. Kids do that. Should
this happen. Tuesday morning, early Tuesday morning.
Yeah. He puts Ethan in his room for the day. I don't know what got into him. And he just decided that Ethan needed his butt whooped.
Stephanie also mentioned that the following day, Nathan had subjected Ethan to physical harm, although she couldn't recall the exact reasons.
I can't remember. I think it's either he wanted to watch TV or he wanted to be right there with Mommy. And he's like, you don't need to be at Mommy's butt. You need to, let, you know, you can do your own thing. You can go play. You've got toys. You know, and I didn't see anything wrong with him being in the kitchen with me. What was wrong with that?
Okay, so Ethan's in the kitchen with you, and then he goes.
He grabs him by the arm and takes him in there. This is the easiest to learn respect.
Was Ethan talking back?
He was crying.
As these inconsistencies were brought to light, both Stephanie and Nathan eventually admitted to a horrifying truth. Ethan was dead, and they had buried him on Powder Mountain. In the midst of pouring rain, detectives descended upon Powder Mountain, concentrating their search efforts near the Wolf Canyon trailhead on State Road 158 in Weber County. Nathan had guided them to this location. Curious bystanders gathered, their mood somber, as they observed detectives carrying shovels to canopies set up at two distinct sites less than a quarter mile up the trail. At around 5 p.m, a collective gasp rippled through the onlookers as officers emerged from the trail with a small blue body bag containing Ethan's remains. He had been wrapped in 8 layers of plastic bags, buried alongside a broken hammer, a shovel head, and a bottle of lighter fluid. Stephanie was arrested on suspicion of child abuse, obstruction of justice, and desecration of a corpse. Nathan faced charges of aggravated murder, child abuse, obstruction of justice, and desecration of a corpse. As the tragic details emerged, it became clear that Ethan had endured just over 2 weeks of unimaginable terror. Back in their teenage years, Stephanie and Nathan crossed paths, but their connection didn't truly form until October of 2009. By that point, Nathan had accumulated a significant criminal record. Between 2000 and 2003, he had been convicted multiple times, including charges of criminal mischief, disorderly conduct, and drug possession. In 2003, he served a 30-day jail sentence for one drug possession charge and later received a 6-month suspended sentence for another. It was during this time that Stephanie and Nathan's romantic relationship blossomed, coinciding with Stephanie's divorce proceedings with Joe. Nathan openly expressed his feelings online, writing, "Instead of provoking my bad boy side, she respects it. She doesn't try and provoke me to protect her, but rather she loves me in ways I couldn't even ask her to." Stephanie also commented on their relationship, stating, "We began with full discourse, so that way our exes couldn't try and use things against us. Someone else's garbage is now my treasure. Though I loved my ex, we just weren't meant to fit together like Nathan and I do." On April 28th, when Stephanie's divorce from Joe was finalised, she and Ethan returned to Layton, leaving Joe behind in Virginia. For the first few days after the move, Ethan maintained daily phone contact with his father. However, this communication abruptly ceased. Joe continued to call every day to speak with his son, but Stephanie provided various excuses for why Ethan couldn't come to the phone. She claimed that Ethan was misbehaving, which seemed out of character for him. During one of their phone conversations, Stephanie informed Joe that Ethan's jaw was in a terrible condition due to an allergic reaction to grapefruit. She also mentioned that she needed to trim Ethan's nails because he was scratching at his jaw. These explanations raised Joe's concerns further, and they didn't align with his knowledge of his son's behavior. What Joe remained unaware of was that shortly after Ethan arrived in Utah, Nathan began subjecting him to abuse. On the 5th of May, Nathan took Ethan into his bedroom, shutting the door behind them, and subjected him to a brutal beating with his fists. Stephanie entered the room and immediately saw the severe injuries on Ethan's face. Despite the extent of the injuries, Stephanie chose not to seek medical assistance. She later explained to detectives that she feared Nathan would be arrested for child abuse if they sought help.
Okay, so they took him into his bedroom?
They go into his room, and I can hear him spanking him. I'm like, okay, what did you see? That's it. He kept doing it.
What did you hear?
I kept hearing Ethan screaming. And I kept hearing, ow, ow, ow. And I had to go snap from because I couldn't bear to hear my baby screaming. And every time I tried to go in there, he grabbed me by the throat and pulled me up against the wall and told me, oh, he needs a lot of respect. If you keep doing this, he's going to be a pussy. He's not going to be a man.
Okay. And what kind of hitting noise did you hear? You said you heard him hitting, and what would you hear?
I heard a smack, 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 like it was on the butt the first time. And then I heard a smack, like it felt like he was smacking his face.
Like a slap?
Like...
You talking about this kind of noise?
Yeah, like this back and forth.
How many times do you think you hit him across the face?
I don't know, because he was trying to be so quiet about it, and I knew he grabbed his face like this.
The subsequent day, Stephanie and Nathan exchanged vows in Farmington. Notably, Ethan was absent, confined to his bedroom at home. The beatings inflicted upon him had reached such severity that the couple feared that bringing Ethan to the wedding would draw the attention of authorities due to his visible injuries. Following their return from the wedding, the abuse persisted, with Nathan escalating the brutality. He determined that mere fists were insufficient, opting instead to scald Ethan with boiling water, resulting in burns covering 17.5% of his body. Ethan was then coerced into consuming 2 16-ounce bottles of water, a 16-ounce bottle of Kool-Aid, and a glass of orange juice over the span of 2 hours. For enthusiasts of classic mysteries packed with twists, June's Journey is the ultimate gaming delight. Embark on an adventure with the endearing amateur sleuth June Parker, uncovering the truth behind her sister's death and unearthing some long-held family secrets. With over 1,000 meticulously crafted scenes, hone your observational skills as you hunt for concealed clues and crucial information. Immerse yourself in the glamorous 1920s through the captivating visuals and engaging gameplay of June's Journey. I've been playing this mobile puzzle game for well over 2 years now, and I often find myself playing late at night as a way to unwind before bed. Among its highlights, June's Journey lets you craft your own island estate and become part of a detective club. Download June's Journey for free on iOS and Android. In an effort to alleviate the facial swelling caused by the injuries, the couple compelled Ethan to take Motrin and Benadryl. Over the next couple of days, Ethan was lethargic and vomiting, and he was unable to eat. He was evidently exhibiting signs and symptoms of a possible head injury or brain swelling. Nathan disclosed to detectives that Stephanie had urged him to toughen Ethan up through frequent discipline, and he admitted to frequently slapping and punching Ethan. Both he and Stephanie subjected Ethan to further torment by making him stand with his nose against the wall while verbally abusing him. Detectives discovered blood spatter on the walls of Ethan's bedroom during their investigation. On the 7th of May, Stephanie returned to the apartment after a shopping trip to Walmart, and discovered that Ethan had sustained severe burns. Nathan claimed it was an accidental burn that occurred in the bathtub.
So after you leave Walmart and come home, how'd you find out your son's feet had been burned?
I completely lost it. I could not believe where my son's feet looked. I didn't know what to do. Nathan put socks over him, not knowing that he'd been burned all the way up his butt.
So his whole leg was burned all the way up to his buttocks area? So he had water had to be pretty deep.
Exactly. His whole foot, well, both feet were covered. The whole back of his legs, all the way up to his butt on both sides.
Back of his legs, not the front?
Not the back. Not the front, just the back.
Burned. Describe what you mean. It's red, blistering.
It wasn't blistering. It was just red. Skin peeled.
The skin did peel. Wow. Some hot water.
Yeah. And my first inclination was, there's no way my child did this.
Stephanie expressed skepticism about Nathan's explanation, but she confessed to detectives that her fear of Nathan prevented her from seeking medical assistance. Nathan countered this by accusing Stephanie of burning Ethan, telling detectives, "The skin's just coming off. I'm trying not to panic. Stephanie's panicking. She's freaking out." As Stephanie was examining Ethan's injuries, she noticed that there were feces inside his mouth. She pushed him into the bathroom and brushed his mouth until his gums were bleeding. When she was questioned about this, she said that she first of all saw it in the bathroom.
What about the fecal material? Where's the feces? Tell me about the feces.
I only saw it on the tub, the wall of the tub. And I only saw it on the tub. I never actually saw it on Nathan.
Was that on Friday night? Good.
Never actually saw it.
So you never saw Nathan, you just saw it in the bathroom. Mm-hmm. On the walls, did you say?
Some smeared all over the walls of the bathroom.
And how was that explained to you?
Ethan reached in his diaper and did it. And my son doesn't do that.
So?
Sorry, I might have a poltergeist kid now, but my kid doesn't do that.
Okay. So what do you think happened?
Honestly, I think he put shit in my kid's mouth, and I think he purposely turned the water up.
And when she looked in Ethan's mouth, she saw it there as well.
So when you got home, Ethan was burned, and feces were smeared in the bathroom wall.
I panicked. I had to clean up all that mess. I panicked. I didn't know what to do with it. It burned so bad.
How did you find those feces in his... How'd you find out that he had feces in his mouth?
He was in the tub and he opened his mouth and he had shit in his mouth.
Okay.
My kid doesn't do that. My kid has never done that. Never. Okay. And it turns out I brushed his teeth last night. No, you didn't. If you did, the next day I would have been brushing more shit out of his mouth the next day.
Uh-huh. So you cleaned his mouth that night too, Friday night? Well, you said this is Friday night.
Friday, late Friday night, I cleaned it, and then I cleaned it again on Saturday.
Okay. So you found feces in his mouth. And you think that Nate was the one that did it?
I don't know.
Okay.
He swears the baby did it. The baby had a speck poop underneath his nails.
So you looked at his nails?
Nothing. Of course I looked at his nails. My mommy.
That's right.
Look at his nails, look at his teeth, look at everything.
And you actually saw some fecal material in his mouth? And Nathan's telling you he did it to himself?
Nathan admitted to detectives that he had placed feces in Ethan's mouth, but alleged that Stephanie had done the same. Additionally, evidence suggested that Ethan's genitals had been subjected to abuse, with Nathan attributing it to an incident involving sitting on the toilet seat improperly. The case had devolved into a he said, she said situation, riddled with conflicting accounts. According to Stephanie, on the 9th of May, she left the apartment to run an errand at the store. Upon her return, Nathan informed her that Ethan was dead in his bedroom. Once again, Stephanie admitted to not seeking help. This time, her reluctance was driven by Nathan's assertion that he would face imprisonment due to the horrendous injuries inflicted on Ethan. Collaboratively, the couple devised a plan to dispose of Ethan's body and mislead detectives. Nathan grabbed a hammer and repeatedly struck Ethan's face to disfigure him and knock out his teeth. Simultaneously, Stephanie obtained 2 cans of lighter fluid, intending for Nathan to incinerate Ethan's remains before burying them. As Nathan explained to detectives, Stephanie was concerned about dental records.
She's also starting to talk to us a lot more.
I was wondering, could we talk? We told you guys everything.
Well, we believe you've told us a lot of things, and in the autopsy today, we actually spent about 4 or 4.5 hours with Ethan.
It was 5.5.
5.5 hours with Ethan this morning. We started about 8 o'clock in the morning with him, and where they unwrapped him and spread him out. And a lot of the things that you told us about, or not me personally, but I know that you'd relate to either Sean or some of the other detectives,
Sean,
about the hammer blows to the head.
Yeah, the actual wound of a rock.
Okay. Did you tell somebody you'd hit him with a hammer?
The partner kept making me to where if I wanted to talk to Stephanie, he kept forcing me about the hammer thing. Mm-hmm. And, the hammer actually broke when we got up there. So
how did the hammer break?
Well, we were trying to soften up some of the soil because I had quite a few rocks in it.
Uh-huh.
And Stephanie was worried about his dental records.
Yeah.
When Stephanie was interviewed about this, she claimed that she had nothing to do with the disposal of Ethan's body, but she was presented with surveillance footage of her purchasing the lighter fluid.
I'm going to have to call bullshit on that answer. You know why?
I can't remember, so I didn't want to say anything.
Because Detective Erickson has been up to Eden, and I told you he was going to go up there.
I know, but I can't remember, that's why I didn't want to lie to you.
And you know what he finds up there on videotape? A happy-go-lucky you buying 2 slushies at Maverick and buying lighter fluid at the King's Market across the street.
I wasn't happy-go-lucky. Nathan told me, and my daddy, what you saw. And Nathan flat out told me if I gave any sign, any inclination, you'd be burying me next.
Okay. This is Detective Erickson.
He's seen the video.
I
believe him. I totally believe him.
So you were just being happy all by yourself with Nate already out of the car, mile or so away, I'm guessing. I haven't been up there. He's up a trail, not even near you. And all you had to do is flag down a sheriff's deputy or call 911 and say, guess what? My husband's up this trail. He killed my son, and he's burying him right now. That's all you had to do. Instead, you're buying slushies with a big smile on your face.
I wasn't trying to. You don't understand how he is.
You tell me how much you loved Ethan.
I love my son. You talk to anyone, they will tell you how much I love my son.
Okay, but you know your son's being buried in the mountains and your brand new husband's going to pour lighter fluid on his body, because why else would you be buying lighter fluid for him? And you're going to take it back to him. He's going to light your son's body on fire, and that's the mom that loves him so much, right?
He was afraid I was going to go to jail.
Ethan's disfigured body was then stuffed into plastic garbage bags. Nathan then drove out to Powder Mountain alone to bury Ethan. He then led Stephanie to the grave so that she could say her last goodbyes. The couple then returned home and continued life as though nothing had happened. Nathan texted Stephanie that same day, "Baby, can you get antioxidant vitamins, please? That would be great. I can't wait to take you to Happy Sumo Memories. Love you." There were a handful of other sexually charged text messages, following which the couple cleaned the crime scene and then went out for a meal at a local restaurant. The next day, they reported Ethan missing. After the arrest of Stephanie and Nathan, detectives discovered that Stephanie's cell phone contained photographs and videos of Ethan's worsening condition, beginning more than a week before he was found dead. They said that the injuries resulted from Nathan engaging in a systematic and progressively more violent pattern of abuse towards Ethan. In one chilling video, Ethan was wearing pajamas. He turned to the camera and said, "I'm having fun with Nathan. He's not scary anymore." In the video, Ethan's cheeks are red and swollen. Ethan then repeatedly asked Ethan whether he wanted to stay in Utah or return to Virginia. A crying Ethan then replied, "My mom, my mom, my mom." In another recording, Ethan looked bruised as Nathan said to him, "Tell your daddy how much you don't like him." Ethan quietly responded, "I don't like you." In text messages, detectives recovered from the couple's cell phones. Nathan had written, "I told you we had a pit bull on our hands, but they learn." Stephanie replied, "Just like mommy, lol." Nathan then responded, "I told you we had to break his ego." And break his ego, they certainly did. A couple of days after this text message conversation, Stephanie wrote, "He is broke, that's for sure." The revelation of the horrific abuse that Ethan had endured weighed heavily on his loved ones, particularly his father, who had never wanted to send him to Stephanie for the summer. He emotionally expressed, "He was a great boy, and even if he was a bad boy, he didn't deserve this. Nobody deserves this. But he was just a good, sweet boy." This disturbing situation raised questions about why Stephanie had been granted custody of Ethan for the summer, especially when Joe had previously voiced his concerns. It came to light that the custody agreement had been approved by Judge Morris Smith, who admitted that she had not thoroughly reviewed Joe's initial petition, expressing apprehensions about Stephanie's suitability as a parent. Judge Smith commented, "He should absolutely not blame himself at all. No parent should ever blame themselves for the unpredictable failures of another parent." According to Judge Smith, no arguments have been made in court regarding the possibility that Ethan would be in danger in Utah. She stated, "Sometimes both parties come to court to get their agreement approved and to get the divorce decree that incorporates the marital agreement. But there was no discussion about what was in that agreement, other than some of the financial aspects. And usually these cases last less than 10 minutes. In fact, this wasn't the first time that Nathan had faced accusations of abuse. Prior to marrying Stephanie, he'd been married to another woman named Jennifer Freeman, who described her ex-husband as mentally unstable, violent, and exhibiting multiple personalities, including one prone to extreme anger when criticized. During their divorce, she expressed fear for her life and the safety of their 6-year-old daughter. Just a month before Stephanie and Nathan began dating, Nathan had left a profanity-laced voicemail to Jennifer, which said, "I only wish now that I could fucking take you out of her life. I'm going to do every fucking thing possible within my power to take you the fuck out of her life. I don't give a fuck if I gotta spend the rest of my fucking life in prison. Fuck you. I'm coming after your fucking throat." He had also made threats to kill Jennifer's boyfriend Mike before warning, "You'll be next in line." Nathan and Jennifer had divorced back in August of 2008, and Jennifer had sought a permanent restraining order against him. As per the court documents, the wife has been the victim of domestic violence. The husband has a felony criminal history for drug-related criminal activity and has, for years, been diagnosed and treated for multiple personality disorders. The night following the discovery of Ethan's lifeless body, around 100 people assembled for a candlelight vigil outside his former home. Within the gathering, conversations flowed as people expressed their wishes for Ethan to have found solace in a better place. Some attendees voiced their hope that Ethan's tragic death would serve as a stark reminder of the importance of neighbours actively monitoring the well-being of children. Barbara Goff, who lived nearby, shared her perspective, stating, "I'm a mom too. I just can't imagine. Not in a million years would I let someone hurt my kids." The location of the candlelight vigil had transformed into an impromptu memorial for Ethan, growing with each passing hour. It adorned itself with stuffed animals, flowers, candles, balloons, and even a Happy Meal signed by the Leighton McDonald's staff. Many cards scribbled in the handwriting of neighborhood children who had not yet had the chance to meet their new neighbor before his tragic death carried messages such as, "I'm sorry you're gone." In addition to the candlelight vigil and the growing memorial, several Facebook pages sprung up in memory of Ethan, resonating with people around the world as they grapple with the heart-wrenching loss. The community sought ways to provide support for Ethan's grieving family and to others in need. Valerie Lingle, a general manager at the Iceberg Ice Cream Shop, orchestrated a teddy bear drive with the intention of collecting teddy bears for police officers and firefighters to offer to children in distressing situations. She stressed the importance of taking action, stating, "I really want people to stop and think about Ethan's death. People need to take action." To alleviate the financial burden, a memorial fund was established to assist Ethan's family in covering funeral expenses and facilitating the transportation of his body back to his father. On May the 15th, the community was deeply disturbed when the district attorney announced that there was insufficient evidence at that moment to charge Stephanie and Nathan with murder. However, this did not signify that changes were not forthcoming, as District Attorney Troy Rawlings emphasized. "Make no mistake, we plan to file charges. We don't want to make any mistakes in our charging decision." The couple remained in custody on other charges, which provided a measure of relief to the community. The delay in filing murder charges was primarily due to the pending autopsy report for Ethan. District Attorney Rawlings clarified, "Before we decide on what is the appropriate and most serious charge we can credibly file, we need to understand the cause of death." While the legal proceedings unfolded, Ethan's body was transported to Virginia. His father, Joe, spoke to the media and expressed his understanding of the delay in filing charges. He asserted, "I don't want any mistakes to be made. I don't want them getting out of this in any sort of way. They need to pay for taking my son away from me." He also indicated his full support if prosecutors chose to pursue the death penalty. Ethan's funeral took place on the 19th of May at the Grundy Funeral Home Chapel. His casket, adorned in blue, was wheeled into the chapel surrounded by photographs chronicling his short life. As mourners settled into the pews, a video montage captured happier moments from Ethan's life, including hiking, fishing, and days out with his father. Minister Mike Reif presided over the service, leading nearly 200 mourners into prayer. He poignantly remarked, "You know our hearts are in a million pieces, but there is no doubt in my mind you can put together all these hearts." During the funeral, Joe spoke, choosing to focus on the joyful memories of Ethan's life, rather than dwelling on the tragic circumstances of his death. He stated, "You never realize how many good people are out there until something bad happens." Minister Reif then told the mourners that if Ethan were here, he would tell everybody that life is precious and do not take it for granted. He stated, "He'd say God is in control and I'm okay. I'm safe." Before concluding the service, attendees were given blue and yellow ribbons as symbols to raise awareness about child abuse. Following the service, Ethan was laid to rest at Clinch Valley Memorial Cemetery. With Ethan's burial complete, his loved ones and the community engaged in discussions about how to prevent such a tragedy from recurring. They contemplated the creation of a federal law that would establish due process for parents who had abandoned their children and sought to regain custody and visitation rights. They proposed naming this law Ethan's Law in memory of Ethan, with the objective of preventing judges and officials from easily returning custody to parents who had abandoned their children, as was the case with Stephanie. A petition advocating for Ethan's Law garnered thousands of signatures in Utah, emphasizing the urgent need for reform. In an effort to raise awareness about child abuse and honor Ethan's memory, hundreds of individuals participated in a 10-mile walk on the 22nd of May. The walk commenced at the apartment where Ethan tragically lost his life, and then continued to the Davis County Justice Center. Calvin Kane, a local father of three, remarked, This is all too little and way too late. But maybe this is the bit of good that can be had from this whole sorry mess. It's the kind of thing you can't make sense of, and you don't want to. Because you don't want to believe anyone could do something like that to a child. Meanwhile, Stephanie and Nathan remained incarcerated, and media outlets sought interviews with them. Towards the end of the month, Stephanie responded to one such request from ABC, with a mocking tone, writing, "Ha ha ha, I've invoked my right to remain silent. Or didn't my attorney already say that?" This letter did nothing to bolster Stephanie's case, and only portrayed her as unremorseful. Just the day after receiving the letter, charges were finally filed against both Stephanie and Nathan. They faced charges of aggravated murder, child abuse, obstruction of justice, and abuse or desecration of a body, with all charges classified as felonies. As per the court documents, the criminal acts included beatings, burning, drugging, isolating, malnourishing, leaving the child alone and unattended while suffering, and refusing to seek vital life-sustaining medical attention. Shortly after the charges were officially filed, Stephanie asserted that she had been coerced into marrying Nathan and expressed her desire to have the marriage annulled. In a court petition, she wrote that her involvement in the marriage was not voluntary and was the result or product of physical duress by Nathan. These claims sharply contradicted her previous online expressions of Nathan as her soulmate and the love of her life before her arrest. Joe speculated that Stephanie might be seeking the annulment to share the last surname as Ethan, and added, "I would be real surprised if a judge accepts that." He further commented, "She looks like a complete idiot because she's the one who set that website up and said all those things about how in love with Nathan she was." After the annulment request, Stephanie and Nathan appeared in court for a hearing related to their charges. During the proceedings, prosecutors revealed that they were still deliberating whether to pursue the death penalty against the couple if they were convicted. In a surprising turn of events, as Nathan stood in the holding area before entering the courtroom, he shouted, "I love you, Stephanie," indicating his awareness of her attempt to annul their marriage. Additionally, it was announced that Stephanie and Nathan would be tried separately. Following the hearing, the couple returned to jail, and ABC4 released a series of letters that Stephanie had penned from behind bars. In her correspondence, she claimed ignorance about Nathan disfiguring Ethan before burying him. She admitted to purchasing lighter fluid, but asserted it was intended for the grill. Stephanie also referred to Ethan as "Mommy's little man" and expressed a bleak outlook on life. Joe responded to the letters and branded Stephanie as a bad pathological liar. He stated, "If she wanted to trade places with Ethan, she should have." Stephanie knew that Ethan needed medical attention but didn't do anything about it. Stephanie then engaged in a jailhouse phone call with a reporter from ABC4, during which she asserted that Ethan's death was an accident despite the evident signs of torture, starvation, and a denial of medical attention. She stated, "As far as what happened with Ethan, I can't get into that, but as far as I'm concerned, I thought he'd always stop." She said she didn't believe that Nathan intended on killing Ethan, but the things just got out of control. Meanwhile, the annulment case was proceeding, but when Stephanie was informed that the case wouldn't be sealed, she decided to drop it. There was a lot of legal back and forth over the next year. In July of 2012, Nathan pleaded not guilty to Ethan's murder. Prosecutors then announced that they would be seeking the death penalty for him if convicted. A preliminary hearing for Nathan was held in March the following year. During the hearing, it was revealed that Ethan had died from scalding, blunt trauma, aspiration pneumonia, dehydration, and over-medication. Prosecutor David Cole said that Nathan was responsible and that his reckless indifference to human life had caused Ethan's death. Dr. David Andranak testified during the preliminary hearing that the concentration of Xanax and Benadryl found in Ethan's body were at adult levels, but they were not the sole cause of his death. He stated, "It's a whole picture in considering how Ethan might have died. Some of the drugs that were found in Ethan's system were Nathan's prescription drugs. Ethan had suffered burns on 17.5% of his body, and according to Dr. Jeffrey Saffel, these burns would have caused a tremendous amount of pain. The burns were to the lower half of Ethan's body, and some skin was burned so severely that it had blistered and fallen off. They were so severe, in fact, that they would have required skin grafting. Ethan was ordered to stand trial, but before then, his defense team challenged the legality of Shelby's law. According to this law, if a child dies any time after an act of abuse, prosecutors could seek the death penalty. The judge ultimately decided that the death penalty could be applied to the case. However, in February of 2014, Nathan changed his plea, and instead he pleaded guilty to the murder of Ethan. He pleaded guilty but mentally ill in order to avoid the death penalty. In exchange for the plea, he was going to be facing a sentence of 25 years to life in prison. Nathan appeared in court, where he made this statement. "Reckless indifference was my state of mind in 2009 and 2010. I was reckless and indifferent in that time of my life, and in the end it was my reckless behaviour and indifference to life that Ethan got caught up in. I'm accountable for my actions. That boy died on my watch, and I'm horribly sorry." Joe was in court to see Nathan plead guilty to the murder of his son. Afterwards, he went out to the area where his son's body had been found. He stated, "It was hard. I've seen all the pictures, but I knew I wanted to go up there and see where they found him at. Part of it was trying to get some closure, but I guess there never will be." He said that the plea deal wasn't what he was hoping for, but said he believed it was the most that they could get. He commented, "I don't even think if we went to trial and he got the death penalty, it still wouldn't be justice for what he did. He took my son. There's no way to get him back. There's no justice at all." In November, Stephanie appeared in court where she too pleaded guilty to the murder of Ethan. She was sentenced to at least 20 years in prison. During the sentencing, Stephanie essentially blamed her actions on prescription medication.
"My selfish behavior is the reason I am standing here today pleading guilty to these charges. Ethan is an innocent child, and I will carry his death penalty as long as I live. Like any burden, it's going to get heavier and heavier. The difference being I can't make it go away because it's part of who I am now. Ethan's death under these circumstances at times is too much to bear. But the fact is I am entirely responsible because I am his mommy. I failed to take care of him properly because I couldn't even take care of myself. My selfishness and failures as a parent caused Puckett's death, and there is no change in the fact that I am the one responsible. Aside from selfishness, my addiction to prescription medication and failure to get help paved the way for this. I failed to recognize the signs, or rather I just out now and ignored them, doing what I always wanted to do, like always. My selfishness wouldn't let me accept the fact that I had problems, let alone that anyone else helped. I am pleading guilty today because I am just that. I chose to abuse my medication to the point I was unable to make sound choices and decisions, thus causing to be reckless and indifferent with my baby's life."
Her defense team had tried to suggest that after Ethan was found dead, Stephanie took prescription medication and passed out, and didn't awake until after Ethan was buried. This, however, was a blatant lie, as she was picked up on surveillance purchasing the lighter fluid that was found in Ethan's grave. Even with the guilty plea and all of the evidence, Stephanie was still trying to claim innocence. After the sentencing, Davis County Attorney Troy Rollins wrote a letter to the Utah Board of Pardons and Parole, in which he said that Stephanie should never be released from prison. He wrote, "Ethan Stacy died because his mother, Stephanie Sloop, was fixated on herself. She cared about her own lifestyle, a lot. Tragically, Stephanie did not care much about the life of her young son. After Ethan was dead, the Sloops celebrated their own lives by dining at favourite restaurants. For the remainder of her life, factual culpability and justice demanded Stephanie Sloop should only dine in the Utah State Prison. Both Nathan and Stephanie Sloop can seek parole from 2055 onwards. Numerous safeguards exist to ensure the well-being of children. But what happens when one of these protective systems fails? Joe Stacey had voiced apprehensions regarding his son, Ethan, spending the summer with his mother. Despite these reservations, Ethan was dispatched to Utah, where he would tragically meet his fate in the very apartment he was sent to. Well, besties, that is it for this episode of Morbidology. As always, thank you so much for listening, and I'd like to say a massive thank you to my newest supporters up on Patreon, Emma and Jane. Morbidology is just a one-woman team, so the support up on Patreon seriously goes such a long way, and I am eternally grateful. Please do check it out if you want bonus episodes that aren't on the regular podcast platforms, ad-free and early release episodes, behind the scenes, and some cool merch. Remember to check us out at morbidology.com for more information about this episode and to read our true crime articles. Until next time, take care of yourselves, stay safe, and have an amazing week.